Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. On the show today, we'll be talking about getting children interested in caring for the environment by teaching them about the Earth's different habitats. And our guest is Andrea Debbink. She is an editor and children's author, specializes in nonfiction storytelling for middle grade readers. And her new book is called The Wild World Handbook: How Adventurers, Artists, Scientists, and You Can Protect Earth's Habitats. So as we listen to her speak, I'm hoping you'll join in. What questions do you have about getting the kids in your life out into nature? How have you helped young children learn about protecting the environment? Join the conversation. You can give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Andrea Debbink, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you for having me today.
You have a love for nature, obviously, but when did that develop? When you were growing up?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I grew up in the suburbs of Minneapolis, and there really wasn't a lot of nature right around where I lived because it was a really new suburb. But I was still just really drawn to always being outside. So growing up in the 90s, pretty much all the kids in my neighborhood would just play outside all the time. And we would play in places like, you know, the vacant lot where the new houses haven't been built yet, or the small grove of trees, across the schoolyard. So we were always seeking out nature, even though there really wasn't an abundance of it at the time where I lived. So yeah, for me, it started very young.
Well, talk about your approach to this book. What makes, you're after middle schoolers, kind of.
Right.
What makes middle schoolers want to read about nature?
Well, I think middle school, certainly for me, when I was in fifth and sixth grade, that's when I began to really start to become aware of the issues facing nature because of the things that we would be talking about in class. I remember back in fifth grade getting the Scholastic News in our classroom, and that's when I first started to learn about things like climate change, acid rain, extinction. And I was starting to connect the dots at that age between my love of being outside and then the issues that were facing the things that I loved outside. So I think this is a good age because at this point, kids have probably had some experience in the outdoors, but they're also gaining that awareness of how what they do affects nature. So I feel like this book is striving to do that. It's to encourage kids to get out even more into nature, but also helping them understand how they can have a positive effect on the environment.
Yeah, I'd certainly agree with you on that. Having gone through your book, it's a really good book. And I have some friends who are on a school board, a grade school board, and the middle schoolers are going to get my copy of your book, matter of fact, for their library. By the way, how did you get in? How did this whole business of writing and authorship and so forth, how did that develop for you over time? What's the history of that?
Well, I've always wanted to be a writer. I think I was probably about 5 years old when I decided that I wanted to write children's books as my career. And over the years, that kind of changed shape a little bit. I ended up coming to the UW here in Madison and studied journalism. And then after that, I went to work for American Girl, which is also here in Madison. And
yeah,
I was an editor at American Girl magazine for about 10 years. And that's where I really started writing nonfiction because my specialty at the magazine and the books that I was writing for American Girl were nonfiction books. And then once I left American Girl a couple of years ago, I just went into full-time writing. And because middle grade nonfiction was the genre that I had been writing in, I just kept pursuing that in the books that I was pitching and writing because I found that I really love middle grade nonfiction. So that's the really condensed version of how I ended up here. Really started out more in magazine and then shifted towards to books, which is what I'm doing now.
You have your book divided into 9 chapters, each talking about a different habitat. Talk a bit about the categories for our listeners.
Yeah, so what I did when, nature is a huge topic. If you want to talk about all the different types of nature in the world, it can be pretty daunting. So I thought it would be easiest if I would just divide it into different habitats, which would help break things down a little bit and make it more digestible for the people reading the book. And I chose 9 different habitats. There are more than 9 habitats in the world, but the ones that I chose were really maybe the more common ones or the larger ones, like you have grasslands or deserts or mountains. These are habitats that exist pretty much on every continent except for possibly Antarctica. So I felt like dividing the book into habitats would kind of make nature as a big topic more accessible. And then it also enabled me to go into greater detail within each habitat, hopefully to reach each reader where they are, because a reader reading the book, they might live in a freshwater habitat or near a freshwater habitat like we do here in Madison. They might live in the desert. They might live in the mountains. So I'm hoping that no matter where the readers live, they're finding a type of habitat that they can personally relate to in some way.
Yeah, I was thinking about that a bit myself. I have a daughter who will be going on to college in the fall, and she wants to be a marine biologist.
And okay.
So I was reading that section with that water section with a lot of interest and found it great. And actually, maybe talk about how the different things that you have within each of the categories. I found them really interesting. I especially enjoyed the stories that you tell about various people in the book. But visit with us about the rest of the items that you will find in the chapter.
Yeah, so for each chapter, so for each habitat that I have, it's divided into 7 sections within the chapter. And really for me, when I first started writing the book, I had the biographies in mind first. As I was thinking about mountains and forests and polar lands, I was researching and thinking about people who had explored those places or written about those places. And I really used their lives as inspiration for the rest of the chapter. So I'm just looking at the mountains chapter here, which is chapter 1, that begins with the biography of Junko Tabe, who was the first woman to climb Mount Everest. And then it goes on from there. There's a natural wonder section where I'm talking about just an element somewhere in the natural world that relates to that specific habitat. So for the mountains chapter, it's the Himalayas. I'm talking about the Himalayan range. After that, there's a field trip section where I give kids ideas on how they can actually go outdoors and interact with that habitat in some way. That's followed by an environmental success story, because I think one thing that's really important as we talk about climate change and ecological crises, it's important to also look at the things that have gone well and the things that have worked as far as helping the environment. So each of the habitat sections includes an environmental success story that relates to that habitat. And then after that, I have a DIY section. And usually that's some sort of craft or art project that a reader can make. And then that's followed by a second biography. And part of the reason for that is I wanted to have just as great of a diversity as possible of the people in the book. But also I had a hard time picking the biographies for each of the chapters, and throwing another biography into each chapter was just a way for me to like solve that problem and be able to fit more stories in. And then each chapter ends with what I call a stewardship section, and that gives readers a way that they can personally, locally, and then more globally do things to help or protect that particular habitat. So there's a lot in each chapter, and it is an illustrated book. So, it's not just all my words on the page. There are some beautiful illustrations by Asia Orlando, who is the illustrator for the book. There's just a lot here, which is why I had to actually break it into these 9 chapters. And break it into two books. There will be a second book coming out that's all based on wildlife, and that'll be coming out later this year in November.
The Ways to Care sections, I kind of liked. I did like those, and I think it was important for you to put them in.
Yeah, yeah, and I think, you know, part of the reason stewardship and conservation is really important to me personally, but I also felt like after you read these biographies of these people that did these interesting or incredible things, it leaves you inspired to want to do something yourself, you know, either follow in their footsteps in some way or also have a positive impact on the environment similar to the way that they did. So the stewardship section was really kind of providing readers with inspiration to then go out and make their own difference in the world.
I really enjoyed reading those stories about people. I think, was it Bob Coomber, was it?
Yeah, Bob Coomber.
Talk, you know, to give people an idea of the kinds of things you write about, tell us about Bob Coomber.
Yeah, so Bob Coomber is a hiker who is based in California. And I first came to know about him because he was actually featured in a documentary called Four Wheel Bob. I'm not sure if you've heard of that. It came out about 3 years ago, and I'd really recommend watching it. But so Bob was born in the 50s in California and had always grown up in the outdoors at the different public parks where he lived. He was a hiker. He loved summoning mountains. And then he was in his 20s, I believe, or it could have been his 30s, when he developed type 1 diabetes. And eventually, because of complications of that, he ended up needing a wheelchair. And despite that very big change in his life, he still loved the outdoors, still wanted to be outside and explore the outdoors. So he, over a period of time, figured out a way to continue to hike while using his wheelchair. And it took a lot of work on his part, but he actually, and I'm looking at the date here so I get it right, in August of 2007, he was the first person to summit a 14,000-foot mountain using a wheelchair. And it was the top of White Mountain, which is the third highest mountain in California. And he did this on a regular hiking trail. You know, it wasn't an ADA-accessible trail by any means. And if you watch the documentary is actually about him trying to summit a different pass in California, but you really get to see his method for hiking and getting over this really rough terrain. And I was just so inspired by his story, but also just by his love for nature and what an advocate he is for just everyone getting outside, no matter your abilities, no matter where you live. And I think that's just a message that can resonate with a lot of people. And just, I really loved his story.
I did too. And it really is inspiring. And I'm sure it's inspiring the young readers who have a chance to look at your book. Andrea Debink, our guest, editor and children's author. Her new book is called The Wild World Handbook: How Adventurers, Artists, Scientists, and You Can Protect Earth's Habitats. Love to hear from you. Give us a call. Did you get involved with environmental activities as a kid? What got you interested? Are there activities in your area to help younger generation understand the natural world? I'd love to hear from you. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. Jill Nadeau, our producer today. Tyler Ditters, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Happy to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about a book that is designed to help children take care of the earth. Andrea Debink is the author. It's The Wild World Handbook: How Adventurers, Artists, Scientists, and You Can Protect Earth's Habitats. Questions, comments, experiences to share, give a call at 800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. And, excuse me, let's take a call. Bill in Madison It's up to you now. Thank you for calling.
Oh, good, Larry. I'm glad to be here for just a second. I just wanted to mention the notion of ecological restoration, which is something I worked at the Arboretum for many years, and that was kind of their distinctive activity. And I and colleagues spent a lot of time thinking about the importance of that, and I wound up writing a book about it called The Sunflower Forest. But it's a great way, and I know that some schools are beginning to use that as part of the way of connecting kids with nature. It's a way of learning about nature. It's a way of being in nature and participating in ecology, and you make quite a case for it. So I just thought I'd toss that in there.
Bill, thank you very much for calling. Andrea, comment.
Yeah, no, I think that's an excellent point. I actually do talk about ecological restoration a bit in the book, because Aldo Leopold is one of the biographies that is included in the book. And I actually mentioned the Arboretum in his biography, because, of course, he was one of the founders, I believe, of the Arboretum, and first got that started, I think, in the 1930s, if I have that date right. I don't have the book right in front of me. I love the idea of ecological restoration. And actually, this is interesting. I'm going to be participating in a Master Naturalist program this fall that actually takes place at the Arboretum, and the topic is ecological restoration. it was something that I was supposed to do last year in 2020, but then, of course, we all know what happened to 2020. So that is a topic. I'm so glad you brought that up, Bill, because that I love that topic myself, and it's something that I want to learn more about.
Oh, absolutely. And you mentioned Aldo Leopold. It was kind of fun to learn or for you to write about what he was like when he was a youngster.
Yeah, and I didn't know any of that before I started writing and researching his biography. And it's just interesting to me. He was, you know, such an example of how your childhood experiences with nature can shape the rest of your life. I mean, it not only shaped his appreciation for it, but of course directed where his life went and where his career went. And, you know, I think it's interesting that when he was a child, I write in the biography that his classmates gave him the nickname the Naturalist because he was just so well known for his love of nature. I think when he was just a teenager, he could identify more than 250 bird species, which totally blows my mind because I like birds, but I could maybe identify like 15, you know, so it's really impressive. Like at what a young age he was already so attuned with the natural world.
Absolutely. Well, let's take another call. Rodney in Western, your turn. Hi, thanks
Hello.
For calling.
Hello, this is Rodney. I grew up in the village of Broco in the 50s. We had a group called the Junior Game Wardens, which was headed by Duane Corbin. We went out and planted trees all over the place and just what a paperback lunch. That was it.
Wow.
Junior Game Wardens, Andrea.
Yeah.
And do you have some favorite organizations? Well, I don't know if favorite, but ones that you kind of like that promote the kids working in the outdoors?
Yeah. One of the organizations that I mention in the book is called Roots and Shoots. Mm-hmm. And that was actually a youth organization started by Dr. Jane Goodall. And she's also a person, she's not in the book, but she's a person who I really admire and have read her work and followed her for some time. And she has always been involved in encouraging kids to get involved in conservation issues. And Roots and Shoots is actually a global organization that I believe has local chapters as well. And I want to say I mentioned that certainly at the end of the book, I might also talk about that in a specific habitat. And I can't remember that off the top of my head.
I think it might have been when you were talking about, was it when you were talking about gorillas in the forest? I'm trying to remember.
It could have been, it probably was.
I think
yep.
It was.
Mm-hmm.
So So Roots and Shoots. Julie emailed that Antigo, Wisconsin's Wild Ones Northwoods Gateway chapter is partnering with schools to help children learn about pollinators and native plants. The pollinator garden they installed is near the public healthy walk path and is planted with natives. It's around the newly constructed Antigo Nobican Forest School facility. That's pretty
That's
cool.
Great. Yeah, that is cool. And I've heard of more schools doing that as well.
There are a lot of school forests in our state, and
yeah.
I think elsewhere, and I think they can perform a great service for youngsters as well.
Yes. Yeah, and it's been really cool to see more schools doing that. In the grasslands section of the Wild World Handbook, I mentioned a school in Illinois that one of the projects that their fourth graders did one year was they got together and planted a 10-acre prairie next to the school. And now they use that prairie as part of the curriculum for the fourth grade classes as they, you know, learn science and about the outdoors. So I think it's really cool whenever schools can do things like that on their own property, or they have places where they can actually take kids to go experience the outdoors and learn the hands-on conservation, you know, because I really think there's no substitute for actually just being outside and learning how to do those things.
You know, as we were talking about trees and forests, I reminded one of the things I kind of like is some of the facts that you bring in, like we have 3 trillion trees.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I thought of that. Oh, 3 trillion, but we could use more, I suppose.
Right. Yeah. And that's what it, and that's a number that scientists were only able to arrive at recently. And I'm trying to remember how they did that. Part of it was satellite imaging that they're able to do now. But it was, you know, really only recently that we even had the capability and the technology to get at an estimate like that. So it's pretty amazing to think about. I can't get my head around that number myself. But
amazing. Most of the people you spotlight aren't as well known as Aldo Leopold, for example.
Right.
But and was it just your own experiences? I mean, you talked about one example, but how did you figure out who you were going to highlight?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think initially, I wanted to make sure that as I was talking about different people who have influenced our, you know, view of nature, I didn't want to just stick with one type of person, you know, so only people who are actually wildlife biologists or activists. I wanted to make sure to get a good cross-section of people who are artists, explorers, you know, like I say in the title, artists, explorers, adventurers, to show that there are many different ways to experience and interact with and protect nature. So one of the things I was very conscious of as I was choosing the lineup of biographies was, okay, do I have some artists in the mix? Do I have some scientists? Do I have some writers? Just to make sure that I get that good mix in that way. But then I also wanted just a diverse selection of people from different time periods, different ethnicities, because one thing that I found early on when I was researching prominent conservationists is I kept coming across the same 5 to 10 people. And it'd be names that you'd recognize, like John Muir and Thoreau, and these names that I grew up hearing. But as I dug deeper into researching people that have, you know, affected the environment and our understanding of it, I was coming across these people that weren't as well known, and it just seemed important to me that we know those stories as well, because I think when you find a story that you can personally relate to, it can inspire you to take action too, and it shows you the difference that one person can make. So like I said, it was really hard. Once I finally did the research, it was really hard for me to narrow down and actually pick the people for the book, because there are more stories, and I'm blanking on the actual names of the people that didn't make it in right now, but I just felt like it was tough when it came down to it, because there really have been so many people that are doing good things for nature and for the environment.
I thought there were some really interesting selections. You take somebody like Minerva Hamilton Hoyt, who didn't really have much of a care about, well, tell about her a bit.
Yeah, and Minerva Hamilton Hoyt was a person that I had never heard of until I started researching the book and was researching deserts in particular. And she is a woman who was born in the 1860s and ended up moving to California around the turn of the century. And she, at the time, was just a socialite out in the Pasadena area. And it was during a time when people were using a lot of desert plants in their landscaping. And at that time, there weren't rules about going out into the desert, digging up a bunch of plants, and then bringing them back home. And that was happening to such an extent with the population boom out in California at that time that the deserts were getting destroyed and these natural habitats were getting destroyed. And she started to notice that herself and really became an advocate for protecting these desert environments. And ultimately, she was really instrumental in the creation of Joshua Tree National Park, which happened, well, it wasn't actually made a national park until the 90s, I believe. It was
Bill
a national
Clinton park. Did it.
yes, in 1994. But it was President Franklin Roosevelt who actually signed the proclamation that created Joshua Tree National Monument. And at that time, it protected 800,000 acres of the desert in California. And that was Minerva Hamilton Hoyt's original intention, was to protect, well, actually, I think she wanted to protect more than 1 million acres. So 800,000 was less than she was wanting, but it was something. And Joshua Tree today is, I think, one of the more popular national parks that we have. And to think that, that it almost didn't happen, you know, because the desert was being destroyed.
And she didn't really even get into it until, I mean, I think her son went off or maybe passed away, and her husband died, and it was, you know, so she was getting, well, she wasn't real old, but she was getting up there in years and got all that started later in life, and look at the success she had.
Right. Yeah, I believe she was in her 50s when that first started, when she first began her conservation work.
Let's take another call. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Crystal in Minocqua, thank you for calling.
Well, hi, Larry. This is a great topic of conversation that I thought I'd weigh in a little bit. I am a delegate on the Wisconsin Conservation Congress up in Oneida County, and it is the only statutory body in the state of Wisconsin that elects citizens from, you know, the counties that they serve in as delegates. And we help advise the Natural Resources Board and the DNR on all things conservation. So we've got really great programs and committees when we talk about environmental, you know, conservation. We talk about heritage, hunting sports and fishing sports. And we also have a youth delegation. So, you know, kids can get involved at a very early age. One, learning about the things that are important in their counties, and two, also how to become involved as great stewards for the state. And so I just wanted to kind of throw that in there in the mix, and thanks for taking the call.
Crystal, thank you so much. Comment, Andrea.
Yeah, thank you, Crystal. I'm so glad you called, because I actually was not familiar with the Conservation Congress. So I definitely want to look you up and learn more about what you do, because that sounds fantastic. And to have a youth element of that, too, I think that's so important to get kids involved locally where they are and to learn more about their state. And especially Wisconsin, you know, we have this conservation heritage here, with Aldo Leopold and Gaylord Nelson. And I think it's so important to keep building on that here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, it was very progressive, the Wisconsin Conservation Congress. Been around for quite a while now. I can't remember when it first started, but it's a wonderful way for citizen input into the kind of planning and the needs, the environmental needs and outdoor needs of our state. And so, yeah, you got to look that up. It's a pretty cool
absolutely.
Organization. They have a meeting every year where everybody can meet on the same night, no matter what county you're in, and make some decisions and make some votes. Well, Rich in La Crosse has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Rich.
Hi, Larry. Hey, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted everyone to know that there is an organization called the North American Squirrel Association, of which I am not a member, but I have used their services. And they have a whole series of locations around the state that have adaptive equipment available to be borrowed for physically challenged folks to be able to go outdoors, not the least of which is some all-terrain wheelchairs that have tracked systems on them, so they work well in sand or snow. And it's simply a reservation system where folks can call in and reserve with their local NASA organization. And they're happy to provide this equipment when it's available. And so just a simple Google search of that group will find some great adaptive equipment to help physically challenged folks be outdoors.
Thank you, Rich. The North American Squirrel Association. Comment on that, Andrea.
That's fantastic. I love hearing about that. And that was an organization I'm not familiar with either. Because as I researched the book, one thing I definitely became aware of in doing that is the different barriers that people face in getting into the outdoors. And there can be a lot of them. And obviously, for a lot of people, there are real physical issues that need to be dealt with in order to get out to these spaces. So that's really awesome that there's a organization that helps people do that. I know, kind of on that same note, I just very recently learned about efforts in the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore, which is a place I love in Wisconsin. I believe, I don't know if it's happened yet or it's in the process of being done. One of the campsites on one of the islands there is being made accessible, wheelchair accessible specifically. And that's just really cool to see because that's actually more of a backcountry experience up there. And to see efforts being made to help people get to those places is really awesome, I think.
It is. I don't know if you've ever seen these new ATV wheelchairs. They are amazing. Have you seen one in action?
I never have. It definitely sounds like something that Bob Coomber could use or would use.
Oh, yeah. I would think that he would. I'm sure he knows all about them, but it's just absolutely amazing to see the kind of terrain, not necessarily even on paths, that these ATV wheelchairs can navigate. So really has opened a door for many people who wanted to get out more and be able to go with the rest of the family.
Right.
Sometimes, you know, and be able to do things as a family and practically no matter where in the outdoors you want to go. So that's great. Barbara in Grand Marsh, your turn. Hi, Barbara.
Hello, my son belongs to my team, Triumph, and what they do is they pull handicapped youth in wheelchairs that are padded by biking them. They take them through the forest preserves, and then they are actually doing marathons where they do 25 miles pulling these children, and then when they get through with the 25 miles, they have 6 miles that they have to push the wheelchair. And it's totally padded, and it's absolutely wonderful, and it's my team, Triumph, and they really deserve a lot of credit for what they do for these youth.
Well, there's Barbara. I did not know about this particular organization, My Team Triumph. Andrea, are you stumped as well?
Yes, I've never heard of that organization, but thank you for calling and letting us know about it.
My Team Triumph. That's great. Well, you are doing, I want to get this in, you're doing a virtual event for the Wisconsin Book Festival next week. Tell us about that.
Yes, so that will be next week on the 26th. The book actually comes out on May 25th, so this is the day after. I'll be doing a virtual event. It's through Crowdcast, so really anybody, no matter where you are, can tune in and watch that event. And I'll just be talking a bit about my journey as a writer, but then also I'll be talking about the book itself, reading a little bit from it, showing some of the illustrations, and just introducing people to the book. So that will be at 11 a.m. And if you aren't actually able to make it to the event, you can access it later on. But also the first, I believe, 100 people who attend the event will receive a free copy of the Wild World Handbook. So if you haven't pre-ordered it, you can get a copy.
And then how do we click in, or where do we click in again?
This would be at the Wisconsin Book Festival website. I'm actually
okay.
I don't know it, but if you go to the Wisconsin Book Festival website, there will be a link there where you can actually sign up, or just the link that you can click on when you attend the event.
Do you have your own website?
I do. Yep, it is AndreaDebbink.com. So AndreaDebbink. And that's where you can see more information about my books, about my writing. And then I also have an author newsletter that's nature-themed that I send out once a month. So all that information is there.
Well, this has been great talking with you today, Andrea. I really like your book a lot. As I said, I'm going to pass it on to a friend at a middle school. And I know it's going, I'm hoping that it finds a wide audience. So thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me, and I really appreciate just the opportunity.
Andrea Debbink is the author of The Wild World Handbook, How Adventurers, Artists, Scientists, and You Can Protect Earth's Habitats. Aimed kind of at middle schoolers, but I got to tell you, I enjoyed reading, especially the little biographies about people that I didn't know existed and the amazing things that they've done. We just touched on a few today. There were many more in the book, and I know you're going to enjoy reading it. And I'm pretty sure you're going to enjoy what's coming up next, because we're going to talk about how to get back into the world after, we'll call it re-entering the world after a pandemic. Shyla Mergay, our guest next. I'm Larry Mehler.